Radio Catskill comes from the Hurleyville Performing Arts Center, with private cinema rental available this holiday season for families, private groups, and parties. HurleyvilleArtsCenter.org. From Upstream Wine and Spirits in Livingston Manor, specializing in sustainable, organic, and biodynamic wine and spirits curated from around the world. UpstreamWine.com. And from listeners like you.
Welcome to the local edition. News and information is going to keep you connected in the Sullivan County Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Jason Dole. And thank you for joining us once again. Coming up tonight, bees. Yes, bees. Sullivan County Community College's Green Building Technology Program has some bees. Art Regal just got done winterizing the hives. Why does SUNY Sullivan have bees? Patricio Robayo spoke to Art earlier today. We will hear that interview coming up. But first, it is Wednesday. And the first thing we do on a Wednesday is we check in with the River Reporter to see what's happening in our listening area. And for that, we turn to reporter Liam Mayo from the River Reporter, who's on the phone with us right now. Welcome back to your spot on the air here, Liam Mayo. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me, Jason.
Thank you for bringing us the news. So what news are you bringing us tonight? Let's start on the Pennsylvania side of the river. I know that you mentioned this redistricting before. Where is that at? Is this congressional redistricting we're talking about?
Yeah, this is on the state level. So the state House and Senate over in Pennsylvania. There was, I think, a separate redistricting that was drawn up in 2018 for federal representatives, specifically those in the House of Representatives. But now we're coming up on the deadline for redistricting on the state level, and that progress is being made on that, essentially. We've got a 5-person committee tasked with doing that, comprised of the House and Senate majority leaders, the House and Senate minority leaders, and one sort of nonpartisan, unelected chair, who's Mark Nordenberg, an expert in law and public policy from the University of Pittsburgh. So they're the people trying to actually do the redistricting, but something that they're sort of focusing on, or that the whole process is focusing on, is getting a lot of public comment and public opinion in as far as how these maps should be drawn. That sort of redistricting committee is holding their own public hearings and providing a lot of data on their process. There's a separate slate of just nonprofit organizations like Fair Districts PA, who are working on sort of taking a bunch of public comments and putting them in a form that that committee can use. And the Governor Tom Wolf has his own sort of advisory committee that he'll listen to when it comes time to decide for his signature on the eventual redistricted map. And that advisory committee is itself taking a lot of public comment. So it's a very technical sort of legislative thing, but it's one that's aiming to get a lot of public comment in on the process.
Well, and it's occurring at a time when more and more people are paying attention to electoral processes in the Commonwealth that the whole nation was looking at when it came to last year's presidential election, and in that federal level redistricting, courts had to get involved to correct some of that districting at the federal level. So I can imagine this is an issue people are following closely in Pennsylvania, even though it's kind of technical and kind of more state level.
Absolutely. And this is a thing people should be following and should be given the chance to have public comment on, which is why it's nice there is so much opportunity for public comment currently in the process. If an eventual legislative map is drawn up that is incredibly gerrymandered or is just flawed in some way, not that I'm saying that's going to happen or that has happened in the past, just as a hypothetical, that could severely impact how much one person's vote matters. So they'd still be casting that vote, but if they're doing it in an incredibly gerrymandered district, that means a little less than it would in sort of an ideal world. So this is people being able to get involved in making sure their votes count for their state representatives, who oftentimes are the ones who can sort of do the most good in their lives. So,
okay, great. And forgive me if you don't know this offhand, or conversely, if you just mentioned it and I missed it, because I'm doing a couple things at once here. But is there a deadline that's hard and fast on the feedback right now?
So there's not an immediate deadline. It's my understanding that the commission is currently working on drawing up a set of maps. Once those maps get finalized, those will be put out to the public. And right. There will be a 30-day public comment period for that. So those maps aren't out yet, but once they are out, there will be a 30-day public comment period, and then it'll go back into the Myers of government to be decided on.
Okay, so 30 days from when those maps come out, and I'll ask you to keep an eye out and let us know when those maps come out.
Absolutely.
All right. Staying in Pennsylvania, another Pennsylvania news, but moving on to sweeter or at least richer topics. What you've got some news about chocolate. What is Bean to Bar?
So in sort of this week's paper, we highlighted this company in Bethany, Pennsylvania called Mocha Origins, which is focusing on, as you just said, Bean to Bar chocolate production. So instead of like just taking in the raw product from unknown sources and turning that into chocolate, it's a company that gets involved in the growing process of the cocoa beans that eventually get turned into chocolate and I believe coffee as well. So it's this one company getting involved in every stage of the process, which means they can sort of vet that process for fairness, for equity, to make sure that everyone's earning sort of a living wage at every stage of their process, and just making sure this is sort of an ethical chocolate bar at the end of it.
Ethical chocolate. I can get behind that. This sounds like, as you say there, with an ethical product, so it sounds to me like a latest iteration of what people were calling a fair trade. And sounds like specific to this industry. Is that what they're kind of aiming for here?
Yeah, they're definitely aiming for that. I believe ethical consumption is one of the newer buzzwords that's being drawn around. And
noted.
one of the things they're trying to do with it is sort of not just sell this product, but educate people on sort of the importance of that. Somewhat more expensive than just an ordinary chocolate bar. Apparently, their bars run between like $8 and $14. But they're trying to educate sort of their consumers that, hey, this is what a luxury like chocolate should cost. If it's dirt cheap once it hits the market, that means somewhere down the line, there's some really messed up business practices going on. Such as the potential for child labor or human trafficking or slave labor. And so you're going to pay a little bit more to get a chocolate bar from Mocha Origins, but you get the peace of mind of knowing that there wasn't anything underhanded involved in the production of that bar. So it's sort of trying to rebalance the market of chocolate towards more what it's worth.
Yeah, and you know, before ethical consumption, there was the fair trade. Before the fair trade, there was just that idea of think globally and act locally. It's like that extra cost, in some ways, is an investment in a better world.
Absolutely, and it's a sort of in a broader sense. It's the rationale behind calls to shop local this holiday season, to shop from people you know, or from vendors you know, or local artists or craftsmanship, especially at a time where there are these global supply chain issues that are fouling up sort of goods made
right.
elsewhere and brought in. It may be a little more expensive to buy sort of a handmade work of art from someone you know, but they're someone you know, and you know that you are making sure that person can earn a living wage by what they're making.
Yeah, and this is kind of where I was going with this, because I'm not like trying to sell chocolate bars, but I like this idea of that you're looking at a local company, that this isn't just about how this local company is dealing with a product that is sourced globally, but it's also in some way almost like commercial karma, like in the sense that like this is how you want local businesses to be dealt with too. You know, things that are made by hand and things that are made the right way, they cost more, whether it's people down the road or people in another country. Liam, is this your story that you wrote that'll be out in the paper?
No, this was an amazing story by someone named Elizabeth Lepro.
Okay.
That's going to be the celebrations feature.
Okay, because, so, yeah, my follow-up was going to be, how was the chocolate, but I'll ask her sometime.
No, I have not tasted it myself, but if I do, I will let you know.
Okay, now over on this side of the river, my side of the river is in Sullivan County. Sullivan County legislature is working out some aspects of the county budget. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so a lot of it is still sort of to be worked out. They're going into meetings over the next few weeks to hash out some of the more technical sides of the budget. But this past week's legislative meetings, they were talking about the salaries of two county employees specifically, Sheriff Mike Schiff and County Treasurer Nancy Buck. Both of those positions are up for re-establishing their salaries following their elections. Apparently, this is something that can only happen after they've just been elected for their next term. So whatever salary gets decided on here will be the salary they earn for the next 4 years. And there was a resolution before the council, or before the committee, excuse me, to set the sheriff's salary at $110,000 and Nancy Buck's salary at $95,000, I believe, annually. And the committee sort of went back and forth on whether those salaries should be where they are. Some members said that they should be higher, that both of those employees have sort of earned more compensation by their service, or that they just are underpaid comparative to people in similar positions, either within the county or outside the counties. And there was sort of a countervailing perspective from other members who said, hey, we need to focus on making sure that all of our county employees are taken care of, that a lot of members of the county are underpaid, and that we need to make sure whatever budget we end up passing takes care of everybody. So the final decisions on that kind of got pushed to a later committee, but it was just an interesting discussion on sort of how setting two people's salaries can have ripple effects through an entire county.
Do you know, is there a rough timeline when this committee... When's the next budget come out, by the way, is what I'm trying to say.
I believe it's coming out by the end of the year, but I don't have a specific deadline by then.
Okay, well, we'll keep an eye out for that county budget here in Sullivan County, and we'll keep an ear out for your news updates here on Radio Catskill. You can hear Liam Mayo from the River Reporter giving you the news on the weekend, throughout the weekend, the latest local headlines, as well as right here on our weekly news roundup. Liam, I want to thank you so much for checking in with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
And I hope you have a great holiday tomorrow.
Yeah, happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving, Liam. Thank you so much. This is a local edition, news and information, keeping you connected. We'll be right back. Going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking about Sullivan County Community College's SUNY Sullivan's Bees.
If you're a morning person, I invite you to join me, Sonia Hedlund, on Ballads and Banjos, 7 to 8 a.m. every Saturday morning, right here on WJFF. Music from all around the world, as well as good old traditional folk music, Saturday, 7 to 8 a.m.
By popular demand, the WJFF Music Sale returns to the White Sulphur Springs Firehouse Saturday. There will be thousands of LPs and CDs for sale, as well as 45, 78s, cassettes, musical instruments, sheet music, stereos, recording equipment, and much more. That's the WJFF Annual Music Sale Extravaganza, Saturday at the White Sulphur Springs Fire Hall.
And just a quick reminder, just a quick notice that, the doors open at 11. People start lining up before that, the music sale. Typically, you got to take precautions against a cold if you do that. And if you're coming into the music sale, you need to have a mask on. That's what we're going to do. It's going to be an indoor masked event. Welcome back to the Local Edition. This is the Local Edition right here on Radio Catskill. And now we're moving on. Art Regal teaches business and courses for the Catskill Hospitality Institute at SUNY Sullivan. Along with a student in the college's Green Building Technology program, he recently spent several hours winterizing SUNY Sullivan's hives, beehives, to help protect and keep them healthy this winter. Why does SUNY Sullivan have bees? And why do you need to keep them safe in the winter? Radio Catskill's own Patricio Romayo spoke to Art Regal earlier today.
Well, we started with Hope Farm in a collaboration with New Hope and building that farm out. And we also have a community garden. So in about 2016, these plans were all coming together and we had the plants there and the garden. And I thought, you know, I was already a beekeeper at home. I already had my hives here and I have my own honey company. And I thought, well, if you're going to have all this agriculture, what would be great is to add some pollinators. Now, there's already wild pollinators there. We've got bumblebees and mason bees and so forth. But I thought, what a great thing would be to get some honeybees there. So I approached the administration. They thought it was a great idea. And we built a bare fence around with some student help. And then I brought some hives in, and we're good to go.
What got you interested in bees in the first place?
I became an empty nester. My kids grew up, moved out, all moved away. And I know I needed something more to do. And I was always interested in honeybees since I was a kid. I saw someone in a bee jacket once we were, you know, going through farm company. And I thought, well, that's pretty cool. You know, it looked like an astronaut to me, right, as a kid. And decades later, when the kids are gone, I thought, yeah, I'm going to try my hand at this. It's a lot better than, you know, running out and spending money on a sports car. So I thought, you know, maybe, you know, a midlife crisis, this could be a little bit cheaper for the family. So we did that. My wife was okay with it. We put some hives in the backyard and we just started to do it. And it's been a good experience.
Wow. And you said you have a company now out of it, right?
Yeah, my company, Covered Bridge Honey in Livingston Manor. It's named after the covered bridge that's right there. And that one and the Beaverkill one, we have great memories of taking the kids up swimming in the Beaverkill beneath the covered bridge there. And we have the Manor covered bridge right here with a park, great county park there. And I thought, well, that's just a great name for a honey company. So that's the name of it. And we started, remember, it was just a hobby. But, you know, the money as hobbies do, money sort of goes out of the checkbook and doesn't come in. And so my wife turned to me one day and she said, you know, a lot of money going out of the checkbook for equipment and bees. And it's like, you know, she says, you need to really just turn this into something where instead of giving the honey away to family and friends, you can sell it and market it and do it, you know, do whatever you want to do and have it sort of self-perpetuating and at least cover some of the costs. So that's why the company came into being.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Now, can you go to the process of protecting the bees that you have at SUNY Sullivan? What goes into in protecting it? What kind of equipment is used? And
sure. So in the fall, and different beekeepers do different things to winterize their hives. In the fall, in the north, we get some really cold weather in the winter. And so what we do is we wrap the hives. You can do it with, I've seen insulation board, you know, that hard sort of foam board used. I've seen, we tend to use 15-pound roofing felt, just a big old roll of that, and we cut some pieces off, and we fold it, and we staple it on. And then on top, you put a moisture board right over the inner cover, and then another piece of rigid foam, so that you cut down on the condensation on the inside of the upper lid, because there is moisture generated in a hive in the wintertime. Bees don't hibernate. People often sometimes think, well, you don't see them flying, so they must be asleep. They really don't. They don't hibernate. They vibrate their abdomens and their wing muscles. They have a way of disengaging their wing muscles, so their wings don't actually have to flap, not flap, but, you know, vibrate. But they can generate heat from the calories they eat by eating the honey that they've stored during the wintertime. So if you wrap the outside of the hive and you put that moisture board and that insulation board on top, it just makes them, they're able to burn less calories and work a little less hard on keeping the cluster warm, because in the middle of that cluster is the queen, and if she dies, it's all over.
Well, definitely. That's actually one of my questions was, what happens to bees in the wild? You went into it a little bit of exactly what happens, but can you go into it, what happens naturally?
They do the same thing, but about 90% of the first swarms in the wild don't make it through the winter. So if a colony swarms, and a colony swarm naturally, that's the way they propagate themselves in the wild. And in fact, I've even had some hives that will swarm. And since we practice sustainable beekeeping, we don't clip wings or anything like that. We try to capture the swarm by having swarm traps out that can provide a new home for the second colony. But if we don't catch them, we don't catch them. They go out into the wild. And they've done some studies, and about 90% failure rate, but about 10% survive, and those are strong bees. They happen to find a log that's got enough or some sort of crevice or space, or even a house, you know, if you've got crevices up in your attic, where they can get in and have and survive through the winter. And then the next year, there's still attrition, but it's not as great, and then you've gone down through the generations. But, you know, they just find a way to hold up. The scout bees look for a new home. But only one out of 10 of them actually survived that first year after splitting from the main hive.
One of the things that stood out to me in the press release that was sent out by Sweeney Sullivan was that bees don't defecate inside the hive. They actually go outside the hive and defecate. And you also mentioned that there are telltale signs of that process. And I'm just curious of what does it look like when bees defecate on snow?
That looks like tiny little yellow drops. Like the snow is spotted with yellow. It's bee poop, right? And it sort of looks like pollen. And yeah, they do what we call them cleansing flights. It's a nice euphemism, isn't it? So they will, on a day that's warm enough for them to fly, they'll fly out of the hive in the wintertime, drop their poop, and they won't fly far, obviously. That's why you'll see the signs, you know, right in front of the hive, and then they'll fly back in. They're very clean, very, very hygienic animals.
Do bees produce honey during the winter, or is this just a seasonal thing?
Right. No, not at all. They consume the honey during the wintertime. The reason bees make honey at all is so that they can store it and eat it during the wintertime. Honey is their food. So honey is the carbohydrates and pollen is the protein. So they need both, right? So when they store honey, it's really to store it for the winter. And when you're practicing sustainable beekeeping, you don't take it all and replace it with corn syrup or sugar syrup or a fondant board or anything. You leave them enough so they can eat that. We leave about 80 to 100 pounds of honey on a hive every year. And commercial beekeepers will take that, and they'll swap it out for syrup or something like that. And all we take is the extra, right? We take the overflow of what they make over and above what they need for the wintertime. But they absolutely have to have a carbohydrate to survive, because, again, they don't hibernate. They eat during the winter, and they'll eat their way up through those stores, and the cluster of bees will actually move upward in a hive, and they'll end up at the top of the hive towards late winter.
In Narrowsburg, they have the Bee Festival, and there's always a big push now locally to to save the pollinators and to save the bees. How is the population now of the pollinators and of the bee population? Has it gotten better?
Actually, because of there has been a boom in beekeeping, hobbyist beekeeping. So every beekeeper, hobbyist that puts even just two hives in their backyard, adds to the population of hives. So it's depends on where you are. It depends on how you're doing your beekeeping. But it's actually, we see a light at the end of the tunnel on bees. We've got a hold of a handle on why bees were dying. A lot of it had to do with, the way they were treated, the pesticides and all that. So we're very fortunate where we are that we don't have any GMO farms or anything around. So pesticides really aren't the problem where we are. We still deal with the Varroa destructor mite. As most beekeepers do, that came in from Asia, about 30 years ago. So beekeepers have been dealing with that for a long time now. But we're trying to breed hygienic bees, where we're trying to bees that can sort of groom those mites off themselves or off other bees. And, there is progress on that. So there's a lot more hope than there was, let's say, 10 years ago. Let's put it that way.
And where are these hives located on the campus?
So we're in what we call the bee pasture. And then New Hope Farm is not that far away. Bees will fly 3 miles to forage, right? So our bees are separated enough that they're, you can see them. You can go in and tour the hives if you want to, but they're not right on top of the farm. So they're, I don't know if you know the layout of the campus. It's they're opposite the science building, and then New Hope Farms is just
where Mirabel points with her mouth.
But they're right on campus. Where
it's great that these students have the exposure to the whole process, from the bees pollinating the fruits and vegetables that's available to the New Hope Community Centers, and also available to the students themselves. So it's great to have this whole ecosystem right there on campus.
Yeah, they're right there. I mean, we separated a little bit because we didn't want anybody to get a little nervous, because there are some people that have just a natural fear of, these are bees, they sting. Even though honeybees don't naturally sting you, they just go about your business. I mean, there's other wasps and those types of bees. Those are more aggressive. So we thought, well, we're going to put them close enough to pollinate, but then we're going to separate them enough so that those folks who are in the farm and might have a little bit of nervousness about having these hives right on top of them, you know what? They don't have to be nervous. So we located it in, I think, the perfect spot. It's a beautiful rolling pasture. It rolls down and the sun sets behind the mountain. You just watch the bees fly and the sun sets. It's a gorgeous spot that we were able to put them in.
The bees have prime real estate there. That's great.
They do have prime real estate. They have their own pasture there. There's nothing else there.
All right, before we go, is there anything we have not touched on that you want our listeners to know about?
We are in the process of actually designing some courses, some non-credit courses, probably a single day, like on a Saturday, in introduction to beekeeping, and then one maybe on how to install a package in late spring. And then I might do one next fall on how to winterize. So I've been talking with the college administration about that. And hopefully, because there are no classes in Sullivan County, that's what I faced when I first started beekeeping. I went all the way to Kingston for my classes. And I thought, now that we, COVID's sort of under control and we can have people on campus, maybe we can have some non-credit classes here next year and, have the community's opportunity to come in and learn some things from me rather than just the internet. The internet has a lot of false information and a lot of good stuff, but you really need to be able to ask someone a bunch of questions and get answers right there. So that's my plan.
All right. Thank you so much for talking to us and letting us know about the bees that are SUNY Sullivan and what it takes to help them out during the winter and keep them safe. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Patricio. Bye.
For Radio Catsco, I'm Patricio Robayo.
And that's going to do it for the local edition here on this Thanksgiving Eve. I want to thank you so much for spending your evening with us, or part of it anyway. We will be back tomorrow evening. We'll have a special check-in with Wayne County Commissioners and a report on these vultures that are congregating in Narrowsburg. So come back for that tomorrow evening at 6:30. Otherwise, hope you have a great holiday. Thank you so much for listening. Let's Talk Vets is next. Do stay tuned.
Support for WJFF Radio Catskill comes from the